It's Current State on WKAR. Good morning. Mark's away, and he'll be back about a week from now. Peter Warfin for Mark on Current State. Glad to have you with us this beautiful morning here in mid-Michigan. We have a lot of mid-Michigan news for you, including a discussion about the new Lansing mass mob. That's a part of that movement that started in western New York and spread to Detroit, where parishioners from all around the diocese, first in Detroit, now in the Lansing area, are gathering into some of the older parishes to help put a little bit extra into the collection baskets and help to keep neighborhood programs going. Everything from that to roller derby in Lansing and much more coming up today on Current State. We'll talk more about Lansing, about Michigan, and even national politics right now with Brandon Dillon. Last weekend, Michigan Republicans held their biannual Mackinac Leadership Conference on Mackinac Island, where several GOP presidential candidates were on hand and several Republicans dipped their toes into the possible statewide election campaigns for 2018. Today, we're going to get some reaction from the leader of the Democratic Party in Michigan about the presidential race, those 2018 races, and more. Our guest on Current State, as I said, is Brandon Dillon. This summer, his predecessor, Lon Johnson, resigned so he could run for Congress in northern Michigan. Dillon resigned his state House seat to take the party chairman's job. Brandon Dillon, thanks for coming into Current State today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Really appreciate it. Let's begin by looking back at the Republican gathering on Mackinac Island last week. Was it last weekend? It seems like it was much longer ago.
Yeah, I think it was last weekend.
I know you weren't there, but several of the GOP presidential candidates were there, of course, including Jeb Bush, Carly Fiorina, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, John Kasich. What did you make of the candidates who were on the island? What was your takeaway?
Well, you know, it was striking to me that you kind of had the second tier of presidential candidates at Mackinac Island. You know, one of the things we noted when the Republican candidates came is that, you know, coming to Michigan, you would hope that they would be talking about middle class bread and butter issues, talking about the auto industry, which, in fact, all of the candidates up there opposed in one way or another, the auto rescue that basically saved the big three and kept thousands and thousands of jobs in Michigan. We would be a totally different state if those folks would have had their way and allowed Detroit to go bankrupt. But, you know, we saw this in the debate as well, where the issues that they were focusing on are Planned Parenthood or talking about war with Iran or other countries instead of talking about those middle class issues. And, you know, in Michigan, I think we're a blue state, but we're not an overwhelmingly blue state. There's people who care about serious policy discussions. And unfortunately, what I saw in Mackinac was just rhetoric appealing to the base. And I don't think that's where we need to be. I think we need to talk about those issues that bring people together. And I think on the Democratic side, you're seeing a real discussion of issues and ideas as opposed to kind of insults and attacks that you keep seeing in the Republican side, whether it's on Mackinac Island or in the presidential debates.
You mentioned that we had kind of the second tier of candidates up at Mackinac Island. When you add in the current front runner, Donald Trump, what do you make of that entire GOP field?
Well, it's certainly an interesting exercise going on. You see the candidates, none of which have held elected office, whether it's Donald Trump, Ben Carson, or increasingly Carly Fiorina, are gathering well over 50% of the primary vote in national polls, where more established candidates like Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and others, governors of major states, Chris Christie, John Kasich, are struggling to survive. And I think it speaks to a real frustration with politics as usual. But I think it also is you're seeing this kind of I think extreme rhetoric coming from Mr. Trump, Mr. Carson, and even Carly Fiorina that shows that the base of the Republican Party is angry. They're responding to kind of these emotional appeals, anti-immigrant sentiment, anti-Muslim sentiment, anti-women sentiment when you're talking about Planned Parenthood that I think is unhealthy for the country as a whole and I think is dangerous for the Republican Party to continue to pursue.
Which candidate maybe is on your mind at 2 a.m, at the middle of the night, when you think of the 2016 presidential campaign, or are you sleeping easy?
Well, I never sleep easy. You know, elections are, you know, Michigan, you know, has not been as competitive at the presidential level lately. But I think there's likely to be a very competitive presidential election in Michigan. And, you know, Michigan is a state that's had many struggles. And in many ways, I think we're doing better than we have in the past, but we're certainly not anywhere we need to be. So, you know, candidates that come in and talk about issues and policies that are going to affect Michigan's middle class, if the Republicans get their act together and start talking like that, could make Michigan competitive. But what we're seeing now is a focus on these extraneous issues that have nothing to do with people's quality of life and ability to earn a living, which the Democratic candidates are talking about. So, you know, I think Michigan obviously Democrats are going to win in Michigan. But Republicans, if they choose to nominate a candidate like Donald Trump or somebody of that ilk, I think you're going to find Michigan very hostile territory.
Another candidate who's kind of in that upper to middle tier, Dr. Ben Carson, seems to be more in the limelight lately, surging in the polls a bit. Yet this week he's been dogged by remarks that he's made about thinking the United States should not have a Muslim president. Can you talk about how Democrats in Michigan tend to do with Muslim voters? Michigan is a state with a significant population.
Well, certainly there's a significant Muslim population. There's also a significant Arab population, which are not necessarily synonymous. But I think just kind of the insulting language, whether it's towards Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, women in general, is not a good Latinos coming from Donald Trump. And I think it's not a good strategy for a political party to alienate a significant swath of the electorate. And I'm proud that the Democratic Party embraces diversity, embraces the best of what people have to offer when they come to this country and become American citizens. This kind of nativist appeals to people that are here and excluding outsiders has a long history in American politics. It's an ugly history, and it's the responsibility of Democrats to push back hard and push back hard against it and make America and this state a welcoming place for those who want to contribute to society, no matter their religion or their ethnic background.
What's been a part of that history, would you say?
Well, I think if you go back to like the Know Nothing movement and the America First movement, there's always this fear of immigrants and others that rears its ugly head in American politics from time to time. And I had thought for many years we've gotten past that, but with the rise of Donald Trump and this kind of, you know, talk about deporting millions of people in this country, you have a rush on the Republican side to become more and more anti-immigrant every day to appeal to a base in the Republican Party that is responding to that message. You have Dr. Carson talking about Muslims being unqualified to be president, even though the Constitution is clear. There is no religious test for the presidency. I think that's an ugly strain in American politics that you would hope in 2015 and going into 2016 would have been something of the past. But unfortunately, we're seeing it be a prominent part of the dialogue on the Republican side. And I'm hopeful that for the country's sake, the Republicans don't nominate somebody with those views.
This is Peter Whorf on Current State. Our guest is Brandon Dillon, chairman of the Michigan Democratic Party. Okay, now that we've talked a bit about the Republican field, how do you feel about the Democrats running for president and what they might do in Michigan? Clinton, Bernie Sanders, O'Malley.
Well, you know, and potentially there may be another candidate entering the race soon. Vice President Biden seems to be exploring that possibility. I would assume if he's going to make that decision, it's going to have to happen very quickly. But look, you know, Michigan, we're hopeful, is going to be irrelevant in the primary process. We're not until the third tier, basically, of primaries after Iowa, New Hampshire, and then kind of the southern states and some of those that are before March 6th. But, you know, the issues that matter to Michigan are issues that matter to the country, and we're encouraging candidates to talk about those issues. The good news, as I said earlier, is on the Democratic side, you don't see the attacks against each other. Senator Sanders, Secretary Clinton, Governor O'Malley are talking about issues, income inequality, college affordability, making sure that we're expanding voting rights. These are a positive message, and they may disagree on the margins about how we best implement those policies or how they would do it as president, but the dialogue has been positive and about issues, and I think that's good for Democrats, no matter who the nominee is, to focus on those issues that the people care about.
What are some of those issues that are very relevant to Michigan that also speak to national issues?
Well, I think one that's increasingly becoming more relevant is college affordability. Just for middle-class families, the daunting notion of sending a child to college and either having that student take on crushing debt or have to take out loans to pay for that college as they go along is something that's increasingly on people's mind. But, you know, income inequality, the way the system is structured to reward those people at the very top and make it difficult for middle class and working class families to get ahead. We've seen, Michigan do better in terms of our unemployment rate, but we're still struggling to get back to the kind of middle class lifestyle that people enjoyed in this state for a long time. So candidates talking about those issues, increasing the minimum wage, making sure that we have protections for people who work hard and play by the rules, those are the things Michigan voters care about. And fortunately, that's what our Democratic candidates are talking about.
Some see candidate Bernie Sanders doing quite well. How do you see that possibly playing in Michigan?
Well, I think he's got a compelling message. And I think it's a message that he's been talking about for many years, about how the system is not fair, and that for those who work hard, whether they're working class, middle class, students, minorities, women, do not have the same opportunities, unfortunately, as people who have enormous wealth. And to make sure that the system is geared towards average middle class people as opposed to millionaires and billionaires is a message that I think not just resonates with Democratic primary voters, but you've seen it somewhat be talked about on the Republican side, where Donald Trump is talking about taxing hedge fund managers and talking about how people like him have been able to spread money across the system to influence politics. People are angry about it. Senator Sanders, I think, has tapped into that. But Secretary Clinton, I think, is also talking about the issues of the system and income inequality that I think overarching messages that appeal to a broad range of people who feel that no matter how hard they work, they're not going to be able to get ahead the way politics is currently practiced in this country.
As we began this part of our discussion about the Democratic candidates, you brought up Vice President Joe Biden. What could that do to the mix?
Well, I think it would be, it's hard to know. Vice President Biden is a compelling political figure. He's been around for a long time, has been a very successful vice president, and I think would have a strong record to run on from the Obama administration. But, I personally... You just want to see more candidates talking about the issues that matter to Michigan. I think that's the best way for Democrats to ensure up and down the ticket that we're going to have a successful 2016 is to stay positive, stay on the issues, no matter who gets in the race or how many candidates come to Michigan to talk about those ideas. I think if we keep it positive and we keep it focused on the issues, it's only going to be good for our eventual nominee.
Brandon Dillon is our guest on Current State today. He chairs the Democratic Party in Michigan. Let's get a little more statewide.
Sure.
and a little more regional and local. Talk about the prospects Democrats have in the 2016 congressional races. Your predecessor chairing the party, Lon Johnson, left to run for Congress in the seat currently held by Dan Benishek in northern Michigan. And Benishek has seemed to be poised to go back on a promise to serve no more than three terms in Congress by running for a fourth term. But he recently decided not to run for re-election. What are Johnson's chances of winning that seat?
Well, I think, Lon first has to get through a primary, but I think the kind of aggressive campaign that he was running up there really forced Congressman Benishek to think twice. The prospect of having to run in that district is always tough, having made a pledge and looked like he was going to break it. But I think an open seat in a presidential year, Democrats have a great opportunity to pick up that seat. And I know Lon is out there working very hard. Jerry Cannon, who ran last time, is also a candidate. But we want to make sure that whoever the Democratic nominee is able to have the resources necessary to compete. And that's one thing I know that Lon certainly has is the ability to raise a lot of money to make sure his message gets out.
Some keen interest in some more local races, with former TV star Melissa Gilbert entering politics to run against Mike Bishop. It's her first run for office. What could she bring to the table?
Well, I think she's a very intriguing candidate. She's got a long history of political advocacy. She was president of the Screen Actors Guild, campaigned very hard for Mark Schauer here in the last cycle. I think she has a focus on bread and butter issues and is going to be a stark contrast to Congressman Bishop, who currently is considered one of the most vulnerable Republicans in Congress. So I think that has the potential to be a really exciting race, and we're excited to help Melissa out at the party level.
We've been talking with the chairman of the Michigan Democratic Party, Brandon Dillon. Thanks for joining us in Current
State. Thanks for having me.
It's Current State on WKAR. Peter Wharf in for Mark today. He'll be back next week. With the Pope's visit to the U.S. this week, the state of the Catholic Church is on many people's minds. There's been a decline in church attendance and in the number of people who identify as Catholic in the United States, and Michigan is no exception. In an effort to bring people back to the church, as well as attract new members, a movement called the Mass Mob has taken off in Detroit, out of Western New York, and now locally. St. Michael Catholic Church in Flint was the first location for the first Lansing Mass Mob. With us in the studio today is Rudy Hoppala, a parishioner at St. Michael's, and by phone, Tom Mann, co-founder of Detroit Mass Mob. Thanks, Tom and Rudy, for being with us today in Current State.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, Peter.
Tom, great to have you with us. The Mass Mob movement started in 2013, coming out of the Buffalo area in Western New York and then into Detroit last year. Remind us, we've spoken about this before. How did it get started in Detroit?
Well, as you mentioned, it started in Buffalo in the fall of 13, and they ran a story on MSNBC News, which was picked up by our Michigan Catholic newspaper. And the editor said, we should do this here. Well, it started on social media. Comments were made, we should do this here, we should do this here. And four of us who didn't know each other actually said, well, we could do this here. Why don't we do this here? And we all started about the same time organizing it. Anthony Battaglia did our Facebook page, Detroit Mass Mob. Jeff Stala started our Facebook group, Catholic Mass Mob of Detroit. I got involved with the very first Mass, and then the second one we had at my church, and I reached out to traditional media. And that's really what helped us tremendously. You know, people still listen to the radio, watch TV, and read the newspapers. Social media has been great, but your help was tremendous.
Tom, how is attending a Detroit Mass Mob a different experience than attending a regular Sunday Mass?
Well, for years I had been going to a lot of the churches in Detroit, and I would be there with maybe 100 people in a church that holds 1,400, 1,500, even 2,000 people. And so probably the biggest difference is when you show up Sunday for a Detroit Mass Mob, you better get there an hour early or at least a half hour early, because we've had 16 of them and we've had standing room only. So naturally, the choir is going to sing louder. The mass, the priest celebrating the mass will be more excited. They'll be speaking, or his sermon will be more exciting. They really are quite an amazing mass to attend.
Rudy Hoppala of St. Michael's in Flint, you're a parishioner. The Mass Mob movement has made its way to us, to the Lansing Mass Mob and our archdiocese. It was the first event at your church this last weekend. Tell us how it went.
Oh, it was exciting. It was awesome. I mean, you know, we've struggled. As Tom has mentioned, we've struggled with a priest who was ailing and not being able to be there, and so on. And we've been without a priest, actually, for about the last 2 years. Well, we as the parish council have been looking at ways to, you know, to bring the people back, because there's such a need in Flint. I mean, we have a desperate need, as many inner city churches do. When the person involved with Mass Mob, Barb Kaloidis, came in to our parish council meeting, everyone just you could just feel the excitement in the room. So we didn't really know what to expect, but we said, yes, we will do whatever we can in order to, you know, attract some people. Mm-hmm. Now, we did not cancel the earlier Masses in the day. We had an earlier 9 o'clock Mass and another one at 6 in the evening. We did not change those, and in retrospect, I wish we would have, because it was, you know, like Tom mentioned, it was exciting to see more people there. Now, we didn't have a huge group, but it's a beginning, and that's the way we looked at it, that let's be on the forefront of this, because we've tried to do that. We have four churches in Flint, that the Catholic churches, that are all at that same point. They're struggling. So we're looking to be on the forefront and have St. Michael's, with the facility that we have, come through and do what we need to do in order to help, you know, all of those in the inner city. So the Mass Mob was just an opportunity, and we saw a lot of familiar faces, people who are not necessarily fallen away Catholics, but had moved for one reason or another that I had mentioned previously. So that part of it, you know, we still had our same priest. We have been assigned by a priest, by the bishop now of Lansing, and so consequently we are glad for that. But it gives us a chance to get the word out to the people, because the rumors for some time were the church is closing. Some people thought the church actually was closed because we didn't have a priest assigned at that point. So the Mass Mob gave us a real fresh start to see that, you know, there's hope there. And that's what we're looking at, is hopefully someday down the road we're going to do another, and we'll be a lot more experienced in how to approach it.
Rudy, I'm going to ask you this question, but first I'm going to ask Tom the question. Tom, Mass Mobs are increasing church attendance when they're held. In your experience, Tom, who exactly are they attracting? Practicing Catholics from around the metropolitan area, non-practicing, other faiths, non-believers, a mixture?
Well, we've had 16 masses so far. And the Facebook page that we have gives us a pretty good demographics of our following. We have about 6,500 people following us on Facebook. As far as the church attendance, predominantly it's in the 45 to 65 range. The other thing that we've had is many of them have been at the historical Polish churches in Detroit, the mothership, St. Albertus, the very first Sweetest Heart of Mary, St. Joseph at. We were just at St. Hedwig's. So they're bringing back a lot of alumni, people who grew up there, who had celebrated their sacraments there. They're bringing, you know, their next generation. A lot of times we have four generations there. But we've also had some younger people. In fact, using the term Detroit Mass Mob, some of the older Catholics, the people in the Archdiocese said, Mass Mob, you know, can you change the name? But Buffalo started that. We're now in 20 different cities. And really, I think Mass Mob, Flash Mob, the young people associate with that. And that was one of our goals, was to try and bring younger people to the masses. And I think it has worked. I've seen and talked to people who haven't been to church in years have come back. But the majority are regular church attendees who wanted to see these beautiful historic churches. For whatever reason, hadn't done it, and our organizing of getting people to church had said, you know what, let's join them. And we now have pretty much a regular following, which is just fantastic.
Rudy, real quick, Pope Francis is visiting the U.S. this week. He's extremely popular, even among non-Catholics and non-Christians. How do you see that popularity affecting the church in the U.S.? Too bad he couldn't be at a Mass Mob.
Oh, yes, for certain. Oh, I think it's great. It is absolutely great. He is such a great human all the way around. And, you know, we're proud that he happens to be Catholic and he has such a following. So we're excited. We're not missing a minute of it. In fact, we're recording all of his speeches that are going to be played at our receptions that we have afterwards. We have coffee and donuts, and it's a big social hour. So we're really excited about that. And also, one point that I wanted to make was that the advantage that we had with the mass mob was that those parishioners who were there at St. Michael had a chance to have one-on-one conversations with some of the people that were there. And that's the key, I believe, in order to attract someone back to the church and to make them feel comfortable.
Well, the Pope has his own mass mob. We know that much for the rest of the week. Thank you very much, Rudy Hoppala and Tom Mann, for talking about the Detroit and the Lansing mass mobs today on Current State.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, Peter.
Coming up on Current State, Michigan teens are back in school, their summer jobs fading into memory, but some teens may be thinking about taking that experience to the next level. A program this weekend in Lansing teaches the basics of building a micro-business to youth age 13 and up. We talked to Peggy Vaughn Payne, Executive Director of the Northwest Initiative, the Lansing nonprofit organizing the event. Plus, break out those roller skates and elbow pads you have sitting in the mudroom. It's time to learn about roller derby in the capital city. Current State's April Van Buren stops by the Lansing Derby Vixens boot camp to figure out what it takes to win on the roller derby rink. That and more after the break on Current State. Current State on WKAR. Thanks for being with us today. Now for Banned Book Week, our book reviewer Scott Southard gives us Catcher in the Rye.
There are few books in American literature as controversial as The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. It has been linked to the assassination attempt on President Reagan and the killing of John Lennon, supposedly inspiring those troubled readers in their unspeakable actions. The novel has become more than a novel. It's become its own literary device. Whenever you see a character in another story or even a movie reading it, you can't help but think that something bad is going to happen. Recently, I read the Judy Blume novel In the Unlikely Event. In that work, a character is given a copy of the book, and along with it, a sense of eerie foreboding. Time magazine listed Salinger's most famous work as the number 4 most banned book in the United States. People who are critical of the book being taught in school point to the work's language and questionable morals. This year, for Banned Books Week, the trick for me was forgetting that controversial history and just focusing on the story itself. At its heart, Catcher in the Rye is a tragic and personal story about a young man just trying to figure out his place in the world. Its feelings about humanity, its desire for meaning and purpose, are all things we readers can relate to. Holden Caulfield is a lonely teenager who has just been expelled from an elite East Coast prep school. The book's timeline spans only 3 days. Holden spends that time wandering around New York City, just begging for someone to really listen to him. And since no one does, he sees everyone as phonies, people that are really not quite human. And that's it. There's not much plot beyond that. Everyone disappoints Holden, from favorite teachers that never seem to say the right thing, to the mentor who makes an advance on him, to the friends who just don't get him. He never finds a love he is hoping for or any reason to believe in humanity. What makes this book dangerous is not its history or hidden intentions. It's the fact that it taps into that part of our psyche that we all share from time to time. Those moments when we look around the world and think everything is ridiculous, phony, and worth hating. Whether it comes from typical teenage angst or simply watching reality television, we all sometimes wonder, does anything really matter? The Catcher in the Rye struggles with the dark thought that maybe everything is fake and meaningless. Most authors will consider such a psychological premise for a short story, but Salinger stretches it out over 200 pages, diving deeper and deeper into Holden's spiritual downward spiral. The difference between Holden and the people that find inspiration in the book's nihilistic philosophy is that Holden does find some kind of meaning in the world. Those 3 days are his exorcism, pushing his pessimistic view of humanity out. In the end, Holden breaks through his angst, finding inspiration in the innocence of his beloved sister stuck on a carousel during a rainstorm. It's sad that this moment of redemption gets far less attention than the morose tone of the rest of the book. In the end, Holden doesn't give up on the world, and maybe that is Salinger's true message. That's not so controversial, is it? For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Current State on WKAR, thanks for being with us today. Michigan teens are back in school, their summer jobs fading into memory. But some teens may be thinking about taking that experience to the next level. A program this weekend in Lansing teaches the basics of building a micro business to youth age 13 and older. Organized by Lansing Community Organization, the Northwest Initiative. And we're talking today with the executive director, Peggy Vaughn Payne. Peggy, thanks for joining us today on Current State.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us a little bit about the overall mission at the Northwest Initiative, please.
The overall mission for Northwest Initiative is to really reach out and help to improve the overall quality of life and health of the neighborhoods in Northwest Lansing. We primarily work with low to moderate income residents.
Right. Your team started the micro business course for teens about 3 years ago, and when the local economy was a little worse than it was now, how did it get started?
It got started because some of our teens were indicating that they wouldn't be able to transition from our academic year program, which met on Saturday mornings, to the summer program because they needed to find a job. They wanted to earn some income.
Right.
And I knew at that time that jobs for teenagers were going to be pretty minimal. If they could find one, we were encouraging. But I said, you know, let's start thinking outside the box because I think it really is important for you to learn some skills to get a job or to, earn some money. So we started talking about looking outside the box and starting, a little small business or small businesses. So we did some research. We talked with the youth about the kinds of things that they were interested in, found a wonderful curriculum by Carol Topp that was micro business for teens. And so it just brought it down to a level that they could understand. And we got it all set, got a couple grants to support it, and started it that summer of 2012 or 13.
Right.
Time flies.
It sure does. Tell us more about, in detail, about some of the skills that you taught in those first classes.
Well, a lot of the skills that they learn is, goes according to the curriculum. They're doing the same thing that a regular adult would do if they're going to learn how to start a business. So it's kind of like identifying, what type of business, whether it's going to be a product base or service, what kinds of materials do you need, putting together a business plan, getting your sales, your marketing. It's the basics of doing a business, but just geared more towards teens. Some of the, outcomes of it is that, the kids are really learning some great skills that will be with them for a life. They're learning leadership, time management, sales, product, service, and pricing, math and accounting. You got to be able, if you're going to make money, you have to learn how to and be sure to know how to count it. Communication and written skills. So they're really honing in on their English. They have to do flyers or business cards, as well as, finances. Just basically, how are we going to fund this? What are the ways that we can look at it, funding a little micro business?
We're talking about a program coming up this weekend to teach micro business skills to local teens looking to become entrepreneurs. Peggy Vaughn Payne is the executive director of the Northwest Initiative in Lansing, which is sponsoring this event. What sorts of cottage industries are teens well suited to pursue?
Oh my goodness, there's so many opportunities for youth these days. Like I said, when our first group started, we had one young man who was doing tutus and jewelry with his mother, and they were selling at $20 a pop. I mean, wow. It was amazing. If he sold two items, he made $40, which was, more than he was going to get somewhere else. We had a girl who was also designing t-shirts and sweatshirts. We had another one who was blinging out shorts. We had one who was baking cookies in bars and selling them at the farmer's market. We gave all of the youth the opportunity, if they had a product, to be able to sell at our Westside Farmer's Market that summer. And many of them did, and they did really well.
Nice. Talk about the curriculum. Your program allows a course designed by Carol Topp, an accountant from the Cincinnati area.
Mm-hmm. It's just a really basic kind of program written you know, by and for teens. So the language is a little easier to understand. It is the basics of, you know, putting together a business plan that you would find if you went to the SBA and pulled up some information or you went to another class for adults. But it's more fun, a lot shorter, and so that we can keep the attention of youth who are wanting to start the business and more fun.
How do you help teens create the business model? What's the process of turning their perhaps vaguely shaped ideas into a focused plan?
Well, that's kind of where, you know, in the group setting, we're talking, and the peers can help sometimes with that as they're trying to hone in on what it is exactly that they want to do. So, for example, I think I've got a young lady that's coming into the class on Saturday who is interested in fashion. Well, that's a pretty big area, so we're going to have to really work with her to, you know, hone in on exactly what in fashion. Is this women's fashion? Is it, you know, pets? Is it, you know, young girls? Help us. And so we will help them by just really talking through a lot of it and so that we can help her be able to pinpoint down exactly what may work and what kind of business that's realistic for her to start at her age.
We're talking with Peggy Vaughn Payne today on Current State. She's the executive director of the Northwest Initiative in Lansing, which is sponsoring the upcoming event, a program coming up this weekend to teach micro-business skills to local teens looking to become entrepreneurs. Is this a course that's open to adults? Has there been any demand for these kind of skills?
Well, that's kind of funny.
Activities?
We when we did the first summer with the youth, we started having adults come to us and ask why we didn't have the program for adults. Mm. And so the following summer, we did allow adults and started a program for adults. And we had several I think it was all women that signed up for that and participated. And so it's been interesting working with adults. We actually used the same curriculum because we didn't know where they were at with their venture, and they enjoyed it. They really did. And one was super ready to go with her business, and she did really well. And she moved to Florida, so I haven't been able to talk to her. But yeah, it's been interesting watching the number of adults. And so we've offered the program since at least twice a year.
Right. How far does your training go with some of these micro businesses, or even how far can you imagine it going?
Well, we're willing to work with any youth who really wants to, you know, stay focused and really work on it. I will spend my personal time working with a youngster on starting a business if they really want to take it to the next level. Most of the kids get the basic training, and they'll decide, you know, whether it's a product or service and what they'd like to do. It may be an extension of a hobby or something else that they've already previously done. And we'll help them. We'll help them with the marketing. That's always a big piece. You know, where can they sell their product or service? You know, what kinds of, you know, is it, if it's mowing lawns, that won't be able to happen, you know, that season is almost over with. But maybe we could say, okay, but what about shoveling snow, you know, that's going to be up on us, you know, soon. So we'll work. I mean, I will work and my staff will really work with the kids because we just think that it's really important that youth have the opportunity to earn some income.
When you give, you always get back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What have been some of the personal rewards for you in helping kids?
Watching them grow,
yeah.
You know, it's amazing to see when they come in. Sometimes they're timid and shy. Sometimes it might have been a parent that pushed them to come. But watching them grow over the course of, you know, 2 to 3 months or longer has been interesting. Watching some of the ones who've grown over the past 3 years that are still working their little business, that's always rewarding to see. And you know, money is a motivator.
Right.
So,
sure.
So, but, you know, and they don't necessarily understand when they're 13, 14 and 15, how these are lifelong skills, but they'll get it, you know, down the road and they're staying with it. So that part is really cool.
Word is you had a family member who was a participant in the
I
past.
Did have a family. I actually had more than a couple, but I had one who stuck with it. That's my son who was baking cookies. And, you know, he's had a following at our farmer's market for the last 3 years.
Nice.
And people that would show up and go, where's Nick? And that was always funny because come September, he's back in school, and we still had the market. And I says, he's back in school. So I was trying to work with him to say, you could do this. I will sell for you, but you have to do it on the weekends and have it ready to go. Market was on Mondays then.
What are his best cookies?
Oh, his chocolate chip. He's got a s'mores cookie right now that he did this summer.
Are they available, like, now?
I wish I had brought some for you. I don't have any. But yes, I mean, if somebody wants to call, he will certainly take orders and has done orders before.
Do you track some of your past students, kind of follow up and see where what they're doing now?
Yeah, occasionally I see them. Haven't followed up with them. I will be doing that because I want some of them to come in and talk to the new class. But I happen to see one of the students probably a couple months ago, early this summer, and he was working and I was at a gas station. And I was like, hey, what's happening? You know, we just had a nice little conversation. So good to always see them. And I will be following up with some to see if I can get them to come in and speak.
Peggy, where can people get more information about this weekend's microbusiness?
They can call my office at 999-2894 and just say that you want to speak with Peggy or Sam or about the microbusiness program.
Peggy Vaughn Payne is the executive director of the Northwest Initiative in Lansing, sponsoring this weekend's microbusiness skills events. Peggy, thanks for being on Current State today.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you so much.
This is Current State on WKAR. Women's roller derby has surged in popularity in this past decade. The sport has actually been around since the 1920s. What started as long-distance races around a track evolved into wild antics and intense rivalries of the 1970s roller derby. You remember those. Jim Croce, roller derby queen. Today, TV shows, movies like the 2009 film Whip It, and it's brought attention of the sport to mainstream audiences. Over 300 leagues across the country compete in the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, including our hometown's own Lansing Derby Vixens. Current State's April Van Buren had a chance to talk with some of the Vixens about what it takes to succeed on the rink.
It's early on a Sunday morning, and I'm at the West Side branch of the Lansing YMCA for a Derby Vixens boot camp. A group of roller derby novices laces up their skates and straps on their elbow and knee pads before heading out on the rink. Wendy Litwiller, or Aerial Attack, as she's known to her fellow derby girls, walks the beginners through some of the basic moves.
So try to do the crossovers and try to really push, like feel the stick with your wheels when you're pushing.
The Lansing Derby Vixens started in 2010 as a small group of women curious about the roller derby world. But as interest in the sport has exploded over the past few years, so has the team's roster. The Vixens now boast three different competition teams, as well as a youth league. Monica Blandford, a.k.a. Goldie Blocks, has been skating with the Vixens for about a year now. For her, the motivation to join the roller derby team was a pretty simple one.
Honestly, I like hitting people. It's the truth. That's why.
But while a healthy dose of aggression can be useful on the rink, there's a lot more to building a successful roller derby team than just pure muscle. Wendy says it can take almost half a year to move from boot camp to a spot on the team.
The 101s or the basic training is about 3 to 4 months long, and then after that you'll be on the team for a little bit. You have, I believe it's a 30-day window before you can even be rostered, and then after that it's 6 weeks before the bout. So It's quite a bit of time before you can even be ready to play, which is not a bad thing, because if you go straight into it, you know, you're bound to get hurt.
Besides a few weeks off in the summer and around holidays, the Vixens are practicing and competing in bouts almost year-round. I ask Wendy what one of those derby bouts looks like.
It's a whole bunch of people on skates doing amazing things. Lots of hitting, lots of fast skating, especially with the jammers. It's a lot of talent, and, you know, you can't just put skates on and say, oh, I'm going to go do a derby and, you know, be in a bout the next day. It's a lot of training and a lot of learning.
Watching one of these competitions can be a little confusing if you don't know what's going on. So Wendy breaks it down for me.
So there's 8 blockers and then there's 2 jammers, one from each team.
Jammers are the point scorers of the game. Think of them as the offensive line of a derby team.
You will win by points. So each person's hips that you pass as a jammer, that's another point.
And blockers are the defense. They try and stop the other team from scoring while protecting their own jammers. And as you probably know, the skaters aren't just calmly tracing circles around the rink. Roller derby is definitely a contact sport, so you've got to be prepared to take a few hits. But Wendy says it's not quite as scary as movies or TV shows might have you believe.
There is still an unbelievable amount of people that says, oh my God, you do derby? Do you like hit people in the face with your elbow and like pull their hair and stuff? And we're like, it's not like the 70s anymore. I promise it's not like that anymore.
For today's boot camp, Wendy is starting with some less painful lessons.
The first thing that we teach them is how to stop. Because if you don't know how to stop, if you're going super fast, you don't know how to stop, you're going to run into someone or run into the wall and you're going to hurt yourself. So the first thing that we teach is the stops. And then we go into a little bit more with crossovers and 180 toe stops. And then we start teaching derby and how to hit after we know how to use our feet on skates on the ground without falling all the time.
The newcomers skate around the rink trying out the new skills they've learned today. They crouch down into derby stance and work on getting as much speed into each stride as possible. There's a few stumbles and falls, but everyone seems to make it through the morning relatively unscathed. Tanya Sherrill is one of the Vixen hopefuls at boot camp today. Her derby name, One-Handedly, stands out in bright white letters against her black helmet. Tanya tells me she never considered herself an athlete, but something about roller derby just felt right.
A few years ago, I went to a couple bouts, and I just got really sparked by something. I'm a fairly competitive person, and I think they get to wear cute stuff, and I've been roller skating since I was 5, so it just seemed to be a perfect fit for me.
I'll be honest, I've watched some of these bouts on YouTube, and the sport can seem a little intense. But Monica, aka Goldieblock, says if you're interested in roller derby, you don't need to feel intimidated or have a lot of experience to join in.
I rollerbladed like 12 years ago, and that was pretty much it. And I was really afraid at first. I was like, oh, I'm not gonna know what to do. Just came out, put skates on, and went from there. It kind of just came back to me, and then just everything kind of flowed.
Which is not to say that learning the game isn't gonna take some hard work. But Wendy says the Vixens want to create as welcoming an environment for newcomers as possible.
We're not just gonna have you come the first day and be like, all right, let's hit ya. You know, we lead into things, and it's never going to be like a surprise, and you're never going to just fall over and be like, oh my God, I'm hurt, because no one told me what's going to happen. So it's a learning process, and we're never just going to pummel you from the beginning, maybe at the end.
After you've gotten the roller derby basics down, then comes the fun part, choosing a name. Wendy, or Aerial Attack, got a little help from her teammates when it came to picking hers.
It was my first scrimmage. I was sitting on the bench, and I had my aerial pants on. And I said, guys, help me. I need a name. It's going to be Aerial something, but I want another name. And Rome was sitting next to me, and she goes, you are Aerial Attack. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds good.
Some of the other names on the Vixens roster include Crisscross Slaughter Sauce, PH Demon, and Mary Popham's. The derby names are so much a part of the team culture that Wendy says sometimes it's hard to remember a teammate's real name.
One of my really good friends, her name is Brianne, and she comes to my office, and I'll still call her Suck It. And people are like, what'd you just call her?
Besides the catchy names and fun outfits, the women I talk to say the real reason they love roller derby is the sense of community. Tanya Sherrill says it was easy to feel welcome here.
The sisterhood is really cool, and they're very encouraging, and nobody judges, and you don't have to worry about having a perfect body or anything like that. It's just everybody makes me feel really comfortable.
The players on the Lansing Derby Vixens have a diverse array of day jobs. Some are engineers, some are lawyers, some are stay-at-home moms. But Wendy says there's one thing that really brings them all together.
You know, everyone's so weird in such a good way, and everyone's weirdness just comes together, and it's just perfect.
The Lansing Derby Vixens' next bout is this Saturday, September 6th at 5 p.m. at the Summit Sports Complex in Diamonddale. And if you're feeling like you want to strap on your old skates and give roller derby a try, the team will be holding another boot camp this Sunday morning at the West Side branch of the Lansing YMCA. For Current State, this is April Van Buren. Or if you want to call me by my public radio derby name, Renee Morpain.
Okay. That's our show for today. Tomorrow we've got an encore episode of Current State with some of the best of our recent shows. And coming up on Monday on Current State, Jesus is a prominent figure in the Quran, a fact that might come as a surprise to some Christians. Current State's Scott Pohl talks with Zaki Saritoprak, author of Islam's Jesus, prior to an appearance on Wednesday in East Lansing. Plus, we've got good news for movie fans, especially those of you who prefer Art House Films to Blockbusters, October's indie film series kicks off soon with a brand new lineup. We'll talk to a series organizer, that's Susan Woods, about what film she's chosen for October. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Peter Worf, your host for today. Thanks for joining us on Current State here on 90.5 and AM 870 WKAR.